Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour. Now, I've not done this for a while, but I received this lovely email this week, and it's really made my day. That's what it's done. And before I read it, I just want to say I always worry that all these people I interview on the podcast here, they all really interest me. But I worry that everyone would prefer it that I just stuck to celebrity. Okay, I do think that often. Yeah, oh, thanks, Tim, for giving us this, but just give us another bloody celebrity. So when I get feedback like this, it really means a lot to me. So let's take a little trip to Ego Corner. Morning, Tim. I wanted to email you to say how much I enjoy your podcast. I've been listening for quite a few years now, and I always look forward to listening to a new episode on Monday morning on my drive to work. I feel I've grown as a person listening to the broad range of guests you have on. That bit is just, that means so much to me, because that's why I'm doing it, because I think the same. Anyway, it goes on to say, annoyingly, none of my friends or wife listen to the show, which results in me regularly chewing the ears off my wife when I learn something really fascinating and she has no idea what I'm talking about. Ha ha. Mate, you've got to get your wife to listen to it. And your mates, spread the word. Come on, tell them all. Just give one a go, because, you know, these podcasts are good. Anyway, he goes on to say, I could write for hours about the way in which you have opened my mind to new ideas and have helped, but I'll keep it short. Listening almost feels like a type of therapy. We all have certain issues, flaws, worries, etc. And your podcast really does help. Keep up the amazing work. Now, I want to say there, this is from Daryl, by the way. I want to say, Daryl, you know what? It's therapy for me too. It really is. I learned so much. I'm definitely finding life more comfortable since I've been doing these podcasts. Look, I'm not rich. I'm not Jeff Bezos from doing this. There's hardly any money I'm making through it. But I do absolutely love doing them because of the knowledge I'm getting and how much I'm learning. So the idea that you think the same thing to me means everything to me. He goes on to say, I'm eagerly awaiting your podcast about your mushroom trial. I'd love to be able to give it a try purely from a psychological perspective. I'm all for regulating, legalizing drugs and would never entertain taking illegally for reasons that are all too clear. I spoke to the drug people I did the trial with actually, again last week. They're waiting to release the results before they talk to me about it. So that will happen as soon as they've done that, and it should happen within the next couple of months. But you know, I think these things take a long time for them to write up the papers and everything from the actual trial. For anyone who doesn't know, I did a psilocybin trial. It's a magic mushroom trial, and so I'm waiting for the results. But it was a properly done trial. Do not take drugs unless you're in the hands of experts. I was. Anyway, thanks to Daryl for that. At this stage, I'd like to thank Cooker as well, because they've been so supportive to me, to us, to the podcast. They've helped keep this podcast going, keep it alive. But more importantly than that, having a company like them interested in this content really means something too. It really does, because they're a great company. I love their product. It's a proper bit of kit. I've got a great relationship with the company, and I really like them. They're great. Look, it's so wonderful that I can recommend their product without feeling, you know, oh God. It's such a great thing to have in your kitchen. For more details, go to cooker.co.uk, cooker spelled Q-U-O-O-K-E-R. If you want to contact me, send me what you think about the podcast or anything else that you're thinking about, or any guests that you're interested in me trying to talk to, you can write to me at tim@lovejoy.co.uk. On today's hour, today's conversation, I'm curious about dealing with fear, and joining me is British snowboarder Amy Fuller, who has written a book called Fear Less, Live More, Everything I've Learned from Testing My Limits. Hi, Amy. How are you?
Mr. Lovejoy, I am good. Thank you for having me back.
Oh, yeah. No, thank you for coming out. I've read your book, which we'll discuss in a minute. First of all, I want to talk about the Winter Olympics, because I just mentioned you were presenting it. I love the Winter Olympics. Obviously, it was overshadowed at the end because a war started with Russia. But up until that moment, I was absolutely fixated by it. Was it a good Olympics, do you think? I mean, terrible for us as a country, but do you think it was a good Olympics?
Yeah, I think as a whole, I think it was a lot better than what everybody was expecting. I think going into this Games, there was, I think, a lot of worry amongst the athletes, amongst staff, amongst broadcasters heading out there, because there were so many restrictions. You know, if you got a positive test 30 days out from the Olympics, so that was essentially around Christmas time, you know, athletes couldn't see their families, and everything went surprisingly, you know, very, very, very smoothly. And in terms of, I think, highlights, we saw some phenomenal performances across the board from athletes from all over the world. So in terms of the world coming back together for that period of time and seeing sport at an elite level showcased, it was pretty spectacular.
Obviously, you're over here, but it was absolutely nuts, wasn't it? Things like the the big ski slope. I can't remember what they call it now. Just stuck in the middle of nowhere with fake snow on it, and so it's kind of mad, wasn't it? Really, it's kind of a strange Olympics in that way.
Yeah, super crazy. I mean, seeing the big air down in the city, as snowboarders, we are kind of used to that, as the big air series does travel around, and essentially it's just blocks of scaffolding that's built up. But they actually had a structure there that is a permanent structure that they've built in the middle of Beijing. And in terms of the actual structure of the jump, it was one of the best jumps. So the facilities were some of the best we've ever seen. But in terms of being unique looking, definitely, definitely very different. And I suppose that's where these Asian Games do have the money and the ability to inject and pump tons of cash in to create these really unusual settings, which just look spectacular.
Yeah. Thought you were really good, by the way, on the broadcast, because it's one of those weird things when you're doing that. You have to somehow get the information across, but you also look like you were having a lot of fun as well. And I think as viewers, we want to know that it's hard, isn't it? Because if you're talking about something like sport, you can drift into being very serious about it and very technical. However, you just made it look like you were having the best laugh ever, which I'm sure you were you?
Yeah, I mean, for me, as much as anyone else does, coming off the back of the 2018 Winter Olympics and competing there, it was a dream of mine to step into broadcast. I feel really lucky to have found something else where I've got that same level of passion. So to be on the other side of it, first and foremost, lining up against the likes of Claire Balding in a studio for 2.5 weeks, I was quite literally living my second dream, which was really special. And I think you're right, Tim, so many people as pundits, presenters, they do look at sport and take it so, so seriously. But having been on the other side of it, I feel like it's all about making the sport as relatable as possible. So when speaking about snowboarding, we're talking about the size of the jumps, and I can compare it to the size of a house or the height of a double-decker bus. And I think it's just bringing little things that people can actually relate to, and not making it so serious, because I think perspective in everything we do needs to be, you know, part of the discussion. And, you know, some of these athletes have trained for 4 years and sometimes it doesn't go to plan. And I think it's important to look at the Olympics as a whole and what these athletes can take from it to drive the rest of their careers forward.
Yeah, I think football needs to lighten up. Jesus Christ, where's all the fun? We're all watching it for a laugh, not for bloody... I mean, some of the stuff happening in football now, I watch it and I have my head in my hands going, Jesus Christ, guys, have a laugh. You're presenting football. Enjoy it, for God's sake. By the way, Claire Balding, brilliant. Hazel Ivan, absolutely amazing presenter as well. The two of those, they're just phenomenal, aren't they, really? But they really know their stuff. Right, Amy... I want to get on and talk about your book. I thoroughly enjoyed reading it. What is it? what's the idea of it? Is it a self-help or is it a biography?
I'd like to put it in the self-help category. It's based on a series of experiences I've had both in and out of sport, and relating that to everyday life. So in terms of it being a biography, I lean on some of my experiences and I share some of my experiences. But again, that's to give the readers perspective and a level of comparison when speaking about things such as running a marathon for the first time, whether it's the London Marathon or whether it's a marathon in a crazy country, for example, North Korea. And then taking everyday life scenarios, as well as wellness and mindset, And it's essentially my little book of, life hacks, so to speak.
Yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed it because the bit I enjoyed was learning all about your career. And the bit that I thought was fascinating was how mentally you dealt with your sport. And that was the thing that I got the most out of your book, because it is a mentally tough sport. You stand the chance. I mean, look, there's no way you can be a snowboarder and go through your career without injury, is there? There's just not a chance because of what you're doing. I remember when I started snowboarding, and I'm crap, by the way, but I do enjoy it. All my mates used to say that the big catchphrase was, if you're not crashing, you're not trying. And that's part and parcel of what you're doing, isn't
it? Yeah, it is brutal. And I think it's about walking that fine line of fear. And that's what I dig into deeper in the book. It's about getting to know fear without letting it control you. And that was something that I struggled with in parts. It's about learning when is the right time to push the boundaries and avoid getting hurt. So it's about putting the building blocks in place so you're ready to try that new trick and you're excited about it rather than being scared. It's about learning from failure and visualizing success, and then the ability to reframe fear and use it as a powerful ally. So I think there's lots of different things that people can take away from it. And I think I really expose myself and open up. You know, a lot of people in action sports don't speak about the fear, and it's definitely something I experienced, especially en route to my second Olympics. It's, do I push for this bigger trick, or do I risk taking myself out of the competition? And for me, it was all about finding the real reason why I wanted to go to my second Olympics, and I used that as my motivation to keep going, essentially. And I think the biggest thing that I can say from this is there's no right or wrong as to what your motivation is. If there's a goal and there is some form of motivation at the end of it, it's about finding a way to channel that and use it to help it drive you towards that goal, so you lose that element of fear.
Yeah, you really do open yourself up in the book. When I was reading it, I kept thinking about Simone Biles, because so many people were hammering her in the Olympics when she was saying, I just don't want to do it because I'm getting the fear of the twisties. And you discussed this in your book, actually, how you suddenly started getting the fear towards the end of your career. And you're very open about it. It must be horrific knowing that you can do it, but the doubts set in. So you must have had a lot of empathy for Simone Biles when she was going through what she was going through.
Yeah, I think it's incredible seeing more and more athletes speaking out about it. And I think, you know, mental health in general being taken more seriously. So 100% empathised with Simone. And it's definitely something I could relate to. You know, you're standing at the top of a jump. You're going off a takeoff the size of a double-decker bus. You're jumping the length of a small terraced house, and your mum and dad are at the bottom watching you. And it's not actually, there's a point when you do get scared, it's not just about you anymore, it's everybody else you're inflicting on your journey. You know, like one thing my dad said to me, and it stuck with me for the majority of my career, and you know, he didn't mean to scare me, but he's like, Ames, the last thing I want to do is like scoop you up and push you around in a wheelchair for the rest of your life. For God's sake, be careful. And you know, he's too true, too right in saying that. But there was always an element of that, because I really am a family person. I live every day for like my family and my friends. And I think you are the definition of the people you surround yourself by. So it got to a point where I essentially lost the love of putting my body, you know, through the utmost danger. And what used to be adrenaline fueled excitement became anxiety ridden fear. And you know, 4 years on, I'm very happy to speak about it, and I found ways of dealing with it, and that's what I delve into in the book. And there's a time and a place as to when to push through that, but I think there's also a time and a place to go, you know what, it's okay, today I am going to step away. And it's not about punishing yourself for stepping away from a situation where you aren't comfortable, because the minute you feel uncomfortable, that's when mistakes do happen. And I've experienced those mistakes many a times. I forget sometimes about the list of injuries I have, and then I go and do something. I'm like, oh yeah, my rib's out of place, and my coccyx isn't straight, and my eye socket is bulging if you look parallel across my face, you know? And that was part and parcel of snowboarding. Don't get me wrong, there were some incredible moments, and the majority of my career, I was living my dream. But towards the end of it, my perspective changed and I had other interests, and I respected myself enough to step away.
So what are the long-term injuries you've got? What are you carrying now?
They're all like small things that you do, I don't think about on a day-to-day basis, but I do occasionally go, oh yeah, like my rib protrudes. So I can't, for example, I can't surf for like more than a day because it sticks out. It's like a giant lump. So then I get like mad chafing and a bruised rib. My eye socket, if you look literally across my face, on my left eye sticks out where I fractured my eye socket. You know, my collarbone is bent. My shoulders are croaky where I've done AC joint, rotator cuff. And, you know, my coccyx is definitely not a straight line. So, you know, those were things that built up over a series of a 13-year career. And I'd like to say I got away lightly with those injuries. You know too well what injuries are like, and they suck and nobody wants to go through it. But I also believe they are character building, and I think they can define your ability to get back up and make you stronger, because they make you want something more often, because you're then missing out on an opportunity when you're hurt.
Yeah, I love all the motivational stuff in your book. It's really interesting when I snowboard, when I fall over on snowboard, you talk about it when you break your coccyx in the book, how painful it is. And you forget just, you know, absolutely when you catch an edge and you go, you're basically on concrete a lot of the time, aren't you? It's like that, but you're going fast. It really wins you and hurts. And you're lying there and you do this thing one bit towards the end where you crash and you go, I'm just checking my boobs are still there and stuff. But you do that. Look, I've never done it at your level. I've only come down. I've never tried to do jumps and stuff, but it hurts. You think the snow's soft. It's not that soft. And then you genuinely lie there going, does my arm work? Does my left arm work? Does my right arm work? Does my left? And then you're just checking, because it's quite a massive thing. And you've done that all your career. Well, you did it all your career. Christ, it's like that took some bravery.
Yeah,
to do.
I think bravery is a great word for it. And I remember specifically that crash at the Olympics, knowing in the back of my mind, I was like, this is the last time I'm going to compete. You know, nobody else knows, but it was like I went down quite literally like a sack of, you know, and the fact that I was able to get up after that and literally just go, wow, I've still got my boobs after I, you know, impaled my brain into, you know, it's hard snow. But, you know, I was like, my head's okay. Wow, is my chest still in one piece? Because when you do have a nasty impact, you know, everything kind of goes numb because of the adrenaline. So you're literally like checking. And when I did my collarbone, again, it was that same thing. It's like the pain dissipates with the adrenaline, but I'm like, wow, my shoulder, my arm's like half hanging off. Am I okay? No, I'm definitely not. I can't move my arm. There's bits moving around here. It's not good. But I think a big part of snowboarding or any sport, or in fact, even in your career, depending on whatever you do, it's about getting so, so comfortable at a certain level, whether it's public speaking in an office, whether it's, you know, running a 5K or a 10K. It's about getting so comfortable at the level that you're at that it becomes boring. You either decide to put the foot down or decide to try that new trick or decide to take that office chat into, you know, a bigger environment, like maybe hosting a podcast or doing a TED talk. So I think it's about getting bored at the level, your operational level, to push your boundaries. And that's how I progressed in sport. It's, yeah, about making everything seem normal. So the next step is purely excitement rather than fear.
How do you go about doing a new trick? How much of it is done in a gym under safety conditions on mats, and how much, or into one of those, you know, those inflatable things you see in the Alps and how much is just like, here we go, I'm going for it?
So the evolution of progression has changed a lot since even I've stepped away from the sport. When I started snowboarding, it was all about trying tricks into powder. So that was kind of the old school way. You'd find, you know, the edge of a piece and you'd build up some bodge looking jump. And I will never forget the day. I think it was 2008, like January, where I tried my first backflip and we built this crazy whippy little jump into soft snow. So back then it was all about trying it into the soft stuff. And now with the technological advancements in reduced risk training, there's a lot of different airbag setups, which is essentially like a giant bouncy castle of air placed on the snow with a takeoff that replicates that of a jump. And then quite often you'll have next to the airbag the same setup, but with a snow landing. So it's all about getting super, super comfortable, but in a reduced risk environment to prevent those injuries happening. There is a lot of air awareness training done now in gymnastics. You'll find a lot of the top free skiers and snowboarders do spend a lot of time on sprung floors as well as trampolines, because it's just a great way of, you know, especially in the summer, just spending more time upside down. The more capable you are upside down in the air, the more time you have in the air, just the more accessible those new tricks are, and the easier everything becomes. It's sort of like a puzzle, and the more you can do of that, the easier it gets on snow.
I'm trying to drag on my I was watching the Olympics this time, so drag on all my experiences to try and find something where I could relate to what you guys are going through. And the only thing I could find was when I did some messing about on Soccer M, I think I might have discussed this with you before. I had to do some sort of trampolining, which I know you did a lot of trampolining. And I had to do backflips and front flips. And you soon realize that actually you're not using your eyes at all. You're using you're feeling it, aren't you? It's a feeling. Because I cannot imagine going around twice and landing something, even on a trampoline. So you're doing it on snow and ice, which is slippery, as it turns out. And so what does it feel like when you're launching into that? Because it's not a visual thing, is it? Because you can't see, you're going too quickly. What does it feel like? What are you using? What's happening?
Okay, so if you were to look at the trick visually and remove yourself from it, and you're to picture yourself doing it, so that's where the visualization comes into play. So every single trick that I ever did, I could do it mentally in my mind and almost project it onto some sort of white chalkboard. And I can visualize myself going tick, tack, boom, the movement, and then the landing. So it's the ability to access the in-run pattern, because that's very important, visualize the movement of the trick and actually feel the movement, and then visualize the success at the end. So that being a landing on both feet. But you're right in saying that it's mental. A huge part of the trick is the mental ability to get the timing right on the takeoff. Because when you're actually doing a trick with such a large rotation, it is hard to see. But there are points within each trick which are essentially viewpoints. So, for example, if you were doing a cab double nine, which is essentially riding in backwards, if you imagine you're skiing, doing a 180 off the lip and then doing a double backflip, your viewpoint, the first one, is under your right armpit. You can see, and then it's a rip in and a hold, and then you're looking for the landing, so you can see the landing. So the whole trick isn't blind, but there are elements of it which are blind, and that's where you have to purely rely on the feedback instinct of feeling. And the only way you're going to get feeling is through practice. So for me, with that trick, it was all about doing as many singles as I could, so I just knew the feeling. And then I knew when I was going around twice, I just had to give it twice as much pop on the takeoff, which is essentially the amount of drive off your back foot up and off the jump. But even that, how do you know what twice the amount of pop is? It's based purely on experience. So it is going to go wrong. unless you've had, you know, months on an airbag. It's never going to be perfect every time. But the more you can do it, the more accessible it is within reach of performing it consistently. And that's what I struggled with towards the end of my career, is because I was really scared of that trick, because there were parts of it that were blind and it was hard to piece together, because each jump varies in size. It requires different amounts of power and pop and strength. So it's quite complex.
Yeah, the book's very motivational. You know, it's a good book if you want to get motivated to do things. Tell us about the two P's, because you're sort of talking about it there. Perspective and practice. You talk about that, the two P's.
Yeah, I think perspective in life is so, so important. And I think it's constantly referring back to what matters to you in life, and then constantly pulling out of a situation and looking at it and going, you know what, really, how much does this matter? How much is this going to define me? And it's about being, you know, okay with certain situations as to when to walk away, or knowing, you know what, I did my best today. It wasn't where I wanted to be, but, you know, I'm not going to punish myself for that. So for me, perspective is really, really important. And I think in approaching anything, if you know you've given it your all, you can kind of walk away from any situation with your head held high and use whatever was learned in that situation to drive whatever the next thing you're doing forward. Because in what I do now, my theory is you're only as good as your last job, because that's what people are looking at. So if I know, you know, I went into the Winter Olympics with BBC, BBC Three, punditry, the full shebang, the podcasting, and I know I gave it my all, that then all I can do is walk away with my head held high, and I'm going to take that experience with what I learned there, and I'm going to channel it and inject it into whatever comes along next. The two P's, perspective and purpose, was it?
Perspective and practice.
Oh, practice. Yeah. And then for practice, I think this is definitely something which really lands with a lot of people, and it's too true that practice is the key to any success. And that's where I talk about the building blocks of progression, which can be utilized in any format. So let's use public speaking as an example. If you're to practice your ability to speak within your own comfort blanket, the more you can do that, whether it's standing like a lemon in front of a mirror with a hairbrush and rehearsing that speech that you're going to do at work, if you don't have the ability to do that and you're not comfortable in your own skin and your own environment, it's going to be very hard when you actually take it to action in front of people. So I think practice, whether it's in sport, whether it's in the workplace, whatever it is, it's about not being ashamed to put in the hard work. So then when the lights are on and it's go time, you're comfortable in that environment, and you can truly enjoy the experience rather than being petrified of what people might think.
Do you believe in natural talent? I mean, you've got to have some sort of talent, I assume, to go with the practice.
I think there's elements of natural talent, but I also think a lot of it comes down to an internal drive and a willingness to learn. I think, you know, obviously physically in sport, some people are maybe built in a different way, which, you know, for example, my little brother, he's the most chilled, laid back guy ever, but he can just do a standing backflip and no one taught him. He could do it in a bar after five beers, or he could do it, you know, walking down the road on the tube in central London. So I believe some people are gifted with an innate ability to be able to jump and flip and spin in a certain direction. But that's not saying that those people that have never done that aren't capable, because it is possible to learn. I learnt backflip and I had no idea how to do it, whereas my brother just did it. But I spent hours and hours and hours and hours practicing on a trampoline in the garden from the age of four. So I think it's all relevant.
I really think the interesting thing is the visualization. The older I get, the more I realize that you learn through watching, you don't learn through listening. I think YouTube has become one of the great teachers. I mean, can you imagine years ago you went to a tennis coach because they were there showing you what to do. Now you can, I'm not saying get rid of your tennis coach, but I'm saying now you can go and watch over and over again Federer hitting shots, and there's no one better at hitting shots. So you're actually visualizing and watching those. Years ago, there wasn't that many snowboarding outlets, was there? So the way to do it is actually to go and, you know, as you say in your book, you actually turned up and started watching these people do it. You analyzed, and you were sitting watching the way they were, their confidence and the way they were turning up and how they were performing their tricks. That's how you learn, wasn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And I'd say a big part of my learning was watching my own riding back and filming as much as I could. And, you know, even time spent in front of a screen learning to edit and create clips. And then, you know, the amount of times you watch something back, I'd say that was a big part of my career. But sometimes it is literally just about getting out there and giving it a huck. So you've got that sense of feeling. And that was definitely something that I had with the front flip. It was like once my coach had kind of shown me the movement pattern once visually, the only way to actually, you know, own and hold that trick within my bag of tricks was feeling and repetition. So I think if you can get a good balance of both, you know, ideally visually first, that's what I find to be the most beneficial for me. But, you know, everybody's different. There's lots of different methods of learning. And you're right in saying the fact that we've got access to watching, you know, clips of the best performing skills. If you can watch that for half an hour before you go and try it, I can 100% guarantee you'll be in a lot better position than if you were to just go and do it. A good example I have of that actually was the first time I ever tried wakeboarding. I didn't really know what it was, but I thought, you know what, this is essentially like snowboarding on water. But how are you to try something like that if you have no idea even how to get up on the board and out of the water? I remember standing on the back of the boat with nobody having a clue how to do it, trying to jump off the back of the boat with the board on whilst holding the lead. And if anyone's listening to this now and they either water ski or wakeboard, they'll know that that's not the way to do it. But that was back when I was 12. And if I'd watched a video on YouTube where you see, actually, you start in the water 30 meters out from the back of the boat, then I probably would have picked it up a lot quicker than trying to hold myself off the back of a boat with a board on. So even though I might have had the ability and the skill set to do it, if you don't understand the dynamics of how to actually start a movement, then you're never ever going to be able to do it. So I think that's where video analysis is incredible.
Yeah, Jack Grealish, who is one of the most expensive footballers in the world, he still, what great hair, lovely looking lad, he still watches footage of greats before he walks on the pitch. His rivals, actually, people of his, you know, of his caliber, he watches them to inspire himself. You know, he talks about it in the World Cup, and I think that's fantastic that he does that. You know, and it's a way of kind of visualizing greats to make yourself feel good about yourself before you go on there. And I know you discuss a lot of that in your book. You're one of the things you mentioned earlier is the problem, not the problem, the thing about your sport is the way you do it is you push yourself as far as you can to that edge without going over the edge. Now, we must say there have been some horrific accidents in sport, cycling and snowboarding and skiing, and it's created severe injuries. But that's your sport. That's what you're doing, isn't it? You're always going as close as you can to that edge because that's how you'll win.
Yeah, it's definitely about walking a really fine line. And essentially the most successful are the ones that have the ability to teeter on that edge where they're just pushing it a little bit further each time. And whether that's adding, you know, 180 degrees more in rotation when the pressure's on, when you're at a competition and you've got that adrenaline pumping, that's a lot of the time when we will see progression and evolution. in the sport. But it is a really fine line, and I've, you know, witnessed some horrific injuries, which, you know, definitely put the fear in me and made me ask the question, you know, is it worth it anymore? Because, you know, it is brutal, but, you know, the moment that you do land that new trick, or you try that thing for the first time, it is the best feeling in the world, and there's very little that can come close to that. So to have been a part of that movement in sport is really special, and I'm just glad to say that I'm not doing it now, and I'm watching the younger girls do it, because, you know, they really are like leading the charge, and the progression of the sport is incredible. But I think more so, Tim, which the thing that I'm most proud of as a snowboarder, and will always be a snowboarder, and I think that's, again, what's special about skiing and snowboarding. These are sports that can be enjoyed recreationally. They're not just elite extreme sports. Is seeing the space that the sport is in, and the camaraderie among the girls and the guys. When new tricks are landed, the field of competitors celebrate success, because there's a lot of respect there, because these sports are dangerous. And when you do try something new, you are putting your body on the line. So to see the level of respect and the camaraderie still within slopestyle, snowboarding and big air, for me, was definitely one of the highlights of the Winter Olympics.
Yeah, it always sort of ruins the Olympics a bit, because everyone seems to be supporting each other, yeah, in Winter Olympics. But not the downhill or anything, but in the actual snowboarding, the big airs, and the skiing, you know, where they do the big airs. All the guys who are doing the tricks are all supporting each other. It seems really lovely, and it's really nice. It's like, it feels like you're at the X Games, but the Olympics isn't about that. I think it should be, by the way. I think it's much nicer the way you lot all treat each other. But, you know, round of applause and high fives to people who are pulling off tricks. I think that's a lovely way of doing it. I tell you what, yeah, is that how it felt at the Olympics, that everyone was supporting each other?
Yeah, definitely in a snowboard girls slope, it was, I think, a real celebration of progression. So in 2018, the event that I competed in, it was not the best show of the sport. They ran the event in the worst conditions we've probably ever seen. It was like minus 20 gale force winds, and essentially it was a battle of the crashes and who could make it to the bottom of the course in one piece. Whereas this Olympics, it really was a showcase and a testament to the level at which the sport is at. And it was more a celebration of like, yes, this is our window and we get to show the world what our sport is about. And I think that's what is so special about action sports. You know, it's a lifestyle, it's a community, albeit a very competitive one. You know, there's still a celebration. We've just shown the world our sport on the main stage at its best. And the people in the sport of snowboarding are unique, they are different, they are special, they are creative, and a lot of them are very, very nice, genuine people, and they're friends that I will have for the rest of my life. I have friends in Australia, Norway, America, and I always found that I rode best when I was riding with my international peers, because we pushed each other, and that's what snowboarding is all about, is pushing the level of the sport.
Why is the Olympics now the ultimate? Because it never used to be. When it first entered the arena, you know, winter sports and the snowboarding and stuff, it felt like the guys were turning up, enjoying it because it was the Olympics, they were wearing the colours of their flag and stuff. But it's not the major event. Has it become the biggest event in the sport now?
I think the thing that's, it's really interesting in snowboarding. So I was very lucky to experience the tail end of what I like to call the glory days. So the big sponsor teams, the fancy trips, the rock and roll lifestyle of being a snowboarder, I experienced that for 3.5 years before the Olympics was introduced in 2014. So the Olympics, I think, has done two things. It's brought our sport to the main stage. For those that are successful, it brings huge, huge commercial interest, and it, you know, really does globalize and, I suppose, bring a layer of credibility to our sport. So snowboarding is no longer seen as, you know, a bunch of drunks and kids rock and roll, like sending it on big jumps. You know, these guys, you know, myself included, that competed the last two or three Olympic Games, I think have added a real layer of credibility to the sport. Everybody that competes is the ultimate athlete and professional, and that's elevated the level of the sport. But I think what it's also done, it's killed a sense of the international community and the big brand teams that we used to have. So I'm with Roxy, which is also known as Quiksilver, and there used to be quite a few teams like that. And to be a part of that and travel the world as a snowboarder with your international peers is really special. But now that's changed, and it's a lot more about FIS, which is the Federation International Ski. So that is essentially how you qualify for the Olympics. So we kind of have two tours running, you know, out of sync with each other. One's the sort of commercial, cool X Games, you know, the big sponsors, the fancy lights, the TV, which is where you earn money out of snowboarding. And then you've got the Olympics, which is, of course, a lot more serious. And it does add, you know, huge value and credibility to our sport, but it's every 4 years. So a lot of it now is about funding, governing bodies, national teams, making sure that, you know, you hit certain fitness specifics. And so it's definitely changed the dynamic. And I think there's huge pluses and minuses to either side. But as a whole, if you were to ask me my opinion on it, I think the Olympics has only been positive for snowboarding. It's just a shame it's lost a few of the characteristics that it used to carry.
Just remind us where you grew up.
So I'm from just south of Bromley, Keston in Kent. I started skiing on the dry slope at the age of four. I did motocross and gymnastics for 2 years. So my base for snowboarding kind of was discovered there. I then lived in the US for 3.5 years, 12 to 16. And that's where I learned to snowboard. We lived in Virginia and I went snowboarding in Pennsylvania. So it was an hour and a half drive, and I used to go up with friends from school. And for me, it was a blank canvas, an outlet for creativity. And I absolutely loved it. It was like gymnastics, but without the regimen. There's a lot of freedom, a lot of time with friends, and it was all about pushing each other. And I think that's why I fell in love with the sport. And it was there that I got noticed. I had no idea I'd been noticed. I moved back to the UK. I'd somehow managed to get into one of the top grammar schools in Northern Ireland off the back of my GCSEs. And for a joke, I put on the form, it was like, what do you want to be when you're older? And I put, for a laugh, a pro snowboarder, because all I dreamt and thought about at that time was snowboarding. But I just knew it probably wouldn't be possible. How, starting grammar school, doing A-levels in Northern Ireland, would I ever become a snowboarder? But 4 or 5 days into the first week at school, I turned up in like Nike high tops, totally Americanized, like no tie, like my eyebrows were being like waxed off, full American style. Everyone's like, who the hell is this girl? And I had a phone call which changed my life, and it was the Roxy European team manager, and said, your name's been thrashed around in the States and thrown my way because I was told, you know, you're a potential talent. Do you want to come out to Switzerland in 2 weeks' time? And that trip changed my life, and I managed to get a few A-levels, but I didn't spend too much time at school.
Do you know what, though? It's a great read. The story's great because it's one of those things that, you know, you weren't born in the Alps. You know, you weren't born in a country which has a mountain, you know, half an hour away. So you had to really believe in the dream, and it's fantastic. I really enjoyed doing it. Let's go to the end of your career, which is really interesting, because you mentioned it earlier about your dad saying he didn't want to be wheeling you around in a wheelchair. And the last bit where you're in the Olympics, you've got your mum and dad there, and you've got your nan and granddad there, and you're representing Britain, and you're representing Roxy. It's what I realized on reading that, and again, this goes back to Simone Biles, is when you're representing, you're not representing Amy Fuller, you're representing so many different people. And you can tell by the way you've written your book, that is something that is important to you, that all these people are there and you're kind of representing them. They want you to succeed. It's not just about you, is it? And that is a a fundamental problem. Just to take this to the final bit with Simone Biles, so all that criticism thrown at her, she probably just wanted to walk. But she's like the sweetheart of American gymnastics. She can't walk. There's too much pressure on her. And I just felt, reading your book made me feel real empathy for her, where she doesn't want to do the twisty. She said it, but everybody's watching going, no, go on, go and do it. You can do it. You're supposed to win everything, even though everything she's achieved. How did that feel for you, standing there about to drop in, and you know that everyone, including Britain, because we've given you the tracksuit and the snowboarding gear and everything else for the day, that all our hopes are on you. Must be a lot of pressure.
It is. There is definitely a lot of pressure, but I think there is an element of it which you can control, and that you have to internalize it, and you have to look your reasons for being there, your motivation, and that's constantly what I kept leaning on. But of course, it crosses your mind. You're like, you know, I want to do well here. I potentially can do really well here. If I land this trick, it's like the difference between a place in the finals and, you know, maybe even a contender for a medal. You know, who knows? You have to dare to dream. So I was definitely in that space. But then you catch your mind wandering. And this is where I knew that, you know, it was my time to step away from competition, because I did allow my mind to wander. I did worry about, you know, affecting my parents if I was to get hurt. And my sole motivation going into that was thinking, you know what, Fuller, just push through, because this will give you the opportunity to do what you want to do next, which was to chase my dream in broadcast. You know, that platform, that Olympic platform, is powerful, and it is more than just sport. It's like I call my snowboarding career like the university of life. Like, I learned so much from being on the road, and, you know, survival skills, essentially, going from the start of my career where you barely earn any money to then, you know, that crazy, like, you know, I'm living the rock star life, I'm living the dream, and I'm riding for all these brands. And then towards the tail end of my career, it's like, wow, this has been really great. I've survived. I'm in one piece. But I'd kind of like to walk away now and do something different. So, yeah, it was a real roller coaster of emotions. And I just feel very grateful that I can walk away from that event, albeit I did impale myself on the last run, which wasn't ideal. But I can walk away with my head held high, knowing that I did have an incredible career. I had some phenomenal results. I was one of the best in the world, but I can also safely park it and not stay attached to the outcome of that final event, because I let my mind drift. I let myself have other interests and other dreams. And I think that's where it all comes down to perspective. No one event, no one life event should define you. And that's the way I look at that day. It could have, you know, gone really well, but it didn't. So I've left it there. I've parked it, and I take elements of that mental capacity to that little battle that I had with myself at the top of the drop in. And I take that into everything that I do now. It's all about perspective.
Do you get scared when you go on TV ever?
You know what? That's a great question. So stepping into this new broadcast role, it's my first time presenting a show. I approached it with sheer excitement. I wanted to put my stamp on it. I wanted to showcase my ability to speak well, inject energy, passion into the broadcast. But I'll tell you what, Tim, the first day, you know, I never presented a show at the BBC on a green screen with, you know, a ton of people watching. But it wasn't even the people watching it on TV. For me, it was all of the eyes that were on me in the control room in the gallery. And I'm like, whoa, this is crazy. But after that sort of first day, I just kept thinking every time I was doing punditry, I'm just having a discussion with Claire Baldwin, or I'm just having a discussion with JJ. And I just focused on that and how we're having a discussion now. I'm chatting with you. I'm not thinking about, oh, I wonder who's going to listen to this. And I think that's really important. But what I do love about it is, I think the one thing where I can compare snowboarding to broadcast is the mental agility you have to be able to adapt. And I kind of see that as an exciting challenge. In snowboarding, it's your mental ability to, change a run if something goes wrong and piece it together. And it's the same with live broadcast. Anything can happen. So I kind of get a buzz and a kick off that, which I think is why I like it so much.
Yeah, live broadcast is the best by miles. And the reason being is that when it goes down, that's when something happens which isn't supposed to happen, or that's when the excitement happens. That's when I earn my money, and that's when I really get the buzz. When I was doing Five Live once, there was a huge, great big incident which happened in the world, and for 1 minute, well, for about half an hour, they went, Tim, you've got to bring in all the reporters. We need to divert away from football. We're talking about this now. And so I was calling in saying, we can cross now live to so-and-so reporter. We can do this, we can do that. And I was like, God, I'm absolutely fucking buzzing here. This is amazing, because it's so exciting, you know. And it's just because you've got to have the ability to, as you say, think on your feet and adapt and try and move. I thoroughly enjoy it. I'm not sure I'd want to do it every day, but I do love doing live TV. Tell us, just while we're coming towards the end here, tell us about, so we can get some tips for people. Tell us about your ladder of excitement or spice. You ladder things, don't you? How does that work?
Yeah, I love a ladder and a bit of mind mapping. So the ladder is something that I used in my snowboard career. And I think it really can be, used in everyday life. So as a snowboarder, you sort of sit and you operate at, day to day sort of level, like 5-6. And you're just kind of cruising there. It's like sort of easily accessible. It's a little bit boring, but you're there. You're there every day with a little bit of effort. You can't just like roll out of bed and be a level 5-6. You've got to put a little bit into it, but you're really comfortable there. And then essentially, if you imagine a ladder, so we've got level 1 to 10, and it's almost like the Nando's spice scale. And each level is sort of a different level of spice. So to enter, the spicy section where you're trying new things are exciting. It's all about stepping into this circle. So there's a circle at the top of the ladder, which is 7, 8, 9, 10. And once you're in that circle, you're operating at this higher frequency. It requires a deep level of focus. Levels sort of 7, 8, you can get there, but you're focused, you're attuned into what you're performing. But the real excitement happens near the top of the ladder. But because you're so well practiced, if you are to fall off the ladder, you've got this innate ability to deal with it. And essentially, the circle will catch you at the bottom of it. So that's always the way I like to think of it. And the circle is almost like a safety blanket around the top, because you've spent so much time practicing at that level 5-6. 7-8 is accessible, and it's all about practicing. So the levels move down and then the progression happens. Probably sounds really confusing. I feel like a photo's needed, but essentially it's all about operating at that slightly higher frequency. So when you do try something new, it's excitement and not fear, but it's spicy.
Yeah. I like that. I do like it. When you were doing your tricks, did you get to a stage where you realised it wasn't going right? And did you learn ways of pulling out of them so you didn't hurt yourself as much? Or did you have to just go through it?
There's certain tricks where there's not really, I like to call it an eject cord, because there's so much momentum involved that once you've hit the takeoff, all of the power is taken into the trick in the takeoff. And if you've taken off with the power for a double, to suddenly pull the eject cord, you'd actually need a parachute to slow you down. So sometimes the bigger tricks, it's all about holding on. So it's staying tight, ripping, and kind of hoping for dear life that if the takeoff went slightly wrong, that you're going to hold it all in and just wait until you see the landing. But it's a long wait when it goes wrong. But if it's a single trick and you get the takeoff a little bit wrong, you know, again, it comes down to comfort level. You're operating at that 5-6. It's pretty easy to pull the ripcord and open things out and slow it down. You know, on a trampoline, you see people doing backflips and they lay them out. We can also do that on a snowboard. So to slow down the speed of rotation, you just really expand and then you bring it back in. So there are ejection methods, but a lot of the time it's all about the rollout ability in the landing and your ability to take impact. And that's where the training in the gym is so, so important. So essentially your body is braced for impact should it happen.
The last time I went into a park, you know, a snowball park or whatever they call those parks in the Alps, whatever, I was so scared. I'd lost the plot with it all and I didn't want to do it. It was like you're saying, that's why I resonate with so much. I was like, oh Christ, am I doing this? And I went on just a box and I'd slowed myself so down so much that I kind of lost momentum and just fell off it. I was like, no, this doesn't hurt. This is just humiliating because I looked so stupid that I didn't even have enough momentum to ride the sodding box. It was ridiculous. So, hey, my mate broke his back getting off a ski lift. Literally went, he must have gone about 10 metres off the ski lift, fell over, crumpled up on the floor. I said, you all right? And he goes, yeah, I think so. He's really, really struggling. And he said, I'm just going to take the lift down. Went to hospital and he'd broken his back. I mean, that is how mad skiing, snowboarding is, isn't it? So they go, quickly tell us about your podcast. We've come to the end, but you must talk about that because it's a great podcast. And I've stolen a couple of
years. Yeah, thanks for the plug. So I listened to the James Smith one. So essentially, I have two podcasts now. So one is called Monday Mile. The concept came about this time last year when we were not allowed to meet people. We were sort of coming towards the end of that third or fourth lockdown. Who knows? I've lost track. But you were allowed to meet people outside and go for a walk, which was our exercise.
Yeah, so I've just got to say at this point, Amy at that stage was living near me and we would be standing outside having a chat with the neighbours for a couple of hours and she would just keep walking round and round and round. She'd see her every. She was just doing laps of the town, of the where we're at. It's like, here comes Amy again. There she is. You love a walk, don't you?
Oh, I love a little walk. I love a walk. And this was the whole thing with the podcast. It's like, how can we take what's been a crazy 18 months of people trapped indoors, let's take the conversation outside, let's keep the conversation moving. And I'm a firm believer that the best conversations happen sideways. So we take all of our guests on a 1 mile walk. Sometimes it may end up a little bit longer, but it's all about motivation and we tap into loads of different areas.
I just
want
to tell you something on that. Colin Salmon, who I've interviewed, actor, used to work with children, troubled children, and he says, if you ever want to talk to your own children, never sit face to face with them. Always do the washing up, sit in a car or go for a walk, because side-on interviews or side-on chats with people, it means they're relaxed and they don't feel attacked. Never try and go and talk to your child face to face. It just doesn't work. They get defensive. Great little tip there from Colin Salmon. What's your second podcast?
Love that little plug. And then the second one is the Olympic Mile. And then we've just finished the Winter Olympic Mile, which was 13 episodes with BBC Sound. So speak to the likes of Tom Daley, Jade Jones in the Summer Games, and then just off the back of the Winter Olympics, Bruce Mowat, Eve Muirhead, Sean White, Gus Kenworthy, the whole shebang. So the creme de la creme of Olympic athletes.
Brilliant. Amy, thank you so much for joining me today. Always a pleasure to talk to you. I love your book. I just sat down, started reading it and couldn't stop. It's, some great advice in there, but it's also just your story's great. And it's a great motivation tool, by the way. Just give it to young people, because if you ever want to be motivated, Amy's the woman who does that. So it's called Fear Less, Live More. And thoroughly enjoyed it. Thanks a lot, Amy.
Thank you, Tim.